The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I've been away for quite a long time. I was sitting a retreat. I am doing my own retreat. Often when I go away, I'm teaching a retreat, but this time I was actually doing my own meditation practice for a month. I was at the Forest Refuge, and so I had such a lovely confirmation of how the retreat practice and the daily life practice support each other. The work, the practice that I've been doing. It's been a long time since I could sit retreat, about 2 years since I sat a retreat of that length. And yet the practice that I was doing during those 2 years, it's like really fed right into the retreat. So it was just so beautiful to really get the confirmation of just how much can happen in our daily lives, in our practice, in our daily lives, just how much wisdom and learning and understanding can happen in our daily lives. And I think this back and forth between retreat practice and daily life practice, it's a great flow to support. So if you ever have a chance to do a retreat, I encourage that. And the daily life practice is really amazing. So I wanted to talk a little bit tonight about the topic, if I just say it to you, which is something along the lines of suffering points the way. It's kind of what I termed this talk to myself. Well, maybe that sounds a little depressing or something. I don't know. Anytime suffering is in the title of anything, it's like, oh, suffering again. We're going to talk about suffering again. But I would like to start by framing it a little bit with the Buddha's journey. You know, I think he started his journey. One way to look at what he was exploring was, I think when he left on his search, he was searching for happiness. He's just searching for where can true happiness be found. He framed it to himself at one place in the text. It says something like, "Why should I search for happiness among what is is impermanent and unreliable? Where can I find true happiness?" And so that was his search, was for happiness. And he went to study with the best teachers of his day, who taught very, very blissful states of concentration. You know, very, very quiet, still, very pleasant experience in those meditations. And yet the Buddha, in his experiencing of those, he studied with those teachers and learned everything they had to offer. And he asked them, he said, is this everything you have to offer? Are you keeping something from me? And they said, no, you've learned everything that I know. And his recognition was, even those states, even those beautiful, blissful, sublime states of meditation ended. And that they weren't a reliable kind of happiness either. You know, he could go into them at will, but that wasn't what he was looking for, was a place to check out of the world, to go into some state, to be happy outside of, to transcend, essentially. He wasn't looking for that. He was looking for some deeper happiness that could be found right in the world, right in the midst of life. And so he realized that the teachers of the day didn't really have the answer to his question, and so he started exploring himself. And I think, I mean, I can't know what was in the Buddha's mind, but from the descriptions of what happened and what he described, part of the way he went about this exploration of how can I find this true happiness was essentially to look at, well, what's in the way of happiness? What's blocking that? Where am I, meeting this struggle? You know, what's going on there? And so his exploration became this exploration of why am I not happy? What is that? What is this sense of dissatisfaction? What is this sense of suffering? What is this sense of struggle? What is this sense of something is wrong? Something is off. And so that's, I think, why the teachings are framed so much in terms of this word dukkha, often translated as suffering, but I think really unsatisfactoriness, unreliability, something like that is a better translation for that term, because it's really pointing to not what we would really call, it does point to the ways that we truly experience pain in this world, you know, the loss of partners, the pain of separation, the pain of loss. But it also points to the ways in which we just feel dissatisfied. You know, like things are just not the way we want them to be. So that term dukkha really encompasses a broad range. And the Buddha's exploration is it possible to be truly happy, to not have that sense of being dissatisfied all the time? And when we look at our lives, when we look at what's happening for us in our minds and our daily life, being honest with yourself, really, I mean, you have to be honest with yourself. Much of the time, what's happening for us is doing something to try to create something that will satisfy us for even just a few moments, or doing something to try to get rid of something that's kind of not satisfying us in this moment. And so a lot of our lives are this kind of push-pull around trying to create a world that will somehow satisfy us. So we're looking at kind of acquisition, acquiring, or creating, constructing something that will make us happy. And one of the Buddhist key insights that he expressed is that anything that's constructed is going to fall apart. Any constructed thing, anything that we create in our world around us, you know, getting the conditions together, it's going to fall apart. Even the constructions of our mind, like the constructions that he was able to do after those studying those very deep meditative states, those were constructions of mind, constructions of peaceful states of mind. Those fall apart. And what he said is any looking towards happiness in creating something, acquiring something, having something, getting rid of something is only going to last for a short time. So it's not going to be a reliable happiness. It's just not going to last very long inherently, because what it is, the happiness that we typically search for is dependent on something that is changing, impermanent, going to fall apart itself. So the happiness will naturally fall apart with the thing as it falls apart. And so as the Buddha came to his understanding, essentially that happiness, deep happiness, true happiness, lies not in having things, but in essentially, it's kind of like endlessly letting go. Endlessly letting go of, well, whatever is flowing through. Kind of allowing that flow rather than trying to stop it and hold it. It's like, you know, in the meditation I was pointing to being with the breath and the flow of life, you know, just going through. And what seems to happen in our practice is that we may allow that flow, but then every now and then it's like, oh, that's nice. Let's stay here for a while. You know, we stop the flow. And we do that in our daily lives as well. It's like, oh yeah, this job, this house, this partner, this is all good. Let's call this happiness. Let's try to hold on to this. And it will change. And so the way that we try to find happiness is inherently unreliable. And this was one of the insights the Buddha kind of poignant, one of the poignant things he saw as he came out of his recognition, his enlightenment recognition, that it's not about having things, it's really about letting go. Not trying to hold on, but just being with, allowing the flow, allowing the process of life to live itself, and not trying to stop it up. In that, there's a deeper kind of happiness that's possible. And he said, in a kind of a poignant recognition, as he looked out at the world, he saw people really wishing to be happy, you know, with a deep wish in their heart for happiness, and acting, trying to fulfill that wish. And yet, as he put it, doing the very things that actually tied them to unhappiness. Because their model, and our model generally, is this model of acquiring, of having, of, you know, being someone, or, you know, being the successful person, or being the person who's liked, or being the one who, you know, has control over their environment. That's where we think we'll find happiness, is in control. I mean, that's one of the places I was really looking at in my retreat, is the, at very, very deep levels of the mind, the desire to control, and how much tension and how much suffering that creates in the mind. So the Buddha suggests that we look at, where are we struggling? Where are we feeling dissatisfied? Where are we feeling unhappy? And that is kind of an avenue, or a gateway for us to understand how to move towards peace and freedom. And that understanding happens not through just, it's kind of like, for instance, anger might come up in our minds, right? Something may happen in our lives that we're not happy with, and we may get angry with that. And initially, we may, you know, have the sense of the self-righteousness and the sense of, yes, I'm right and I need to figure this out and fix this and change this. And we may be more focused on the outer world and trying to fix and change things, and not really be, I mean, if somebody came up and asked us, are you angry? It's like, well, yeah, I know I'm angry. But it's kind of the kind of knowing of that anger that helps us to see the path towards a deeper kind of happiness is not that kind of knowing that we're angry in our normal mode, but a turning towards the, and what does it feel like? What is it like to be a human being that is angry? So it's really a deep acknowledgement of the state of being while angry. Rather than being focused on the thing we're angry about, we turn towards the experience of anger. That's a huge difference in those two. And that shift, that the texts call that careful attention or wise attention to our experience. That attending wisely. So wise attention to how we feel like we're struggling, how we feel like we're caught, or how we feel like things are off. Wise attention, which is that turning towards, what is it like to be a human being that's feeling this offness? What is it like to be a human being that's feeling this frustration or anger or agitation or annoyance? Whatever it is, what is it like? That will begin to point us in the direction of a deeper happiness. Because what seems to happen is that our minds, in that exploration, begin to really get that those states of mind are not conducive of well-being, not conducive of true happiness. When we're focused on what's out in the world and organizing, arranging, fixing, changing, our minds are deluding us into thinking that we are headed towards well-being. And as soon as we turn to how we are in this moment, in that state, that wise attention makes it really clear, this is not the way to well-being. And so the mind begins to get an education. It gets an education about what really will help us and what leads us down the wrong path. So that turning towards our struggles, our suffering, is a key towards this understanding. This is actually an expression of the First Noble Truth. The Buddha stated, there is suffering, there is dukkha, there is unsatisfactoriness, there is unreliability. I like that framing of it. I mean, nobody's going to argue with that. Things are unreliable. Yeah, okay, I'll buy that. Things are suffering? That's a little harder to take sometimes, that framing of it. But things are unreliable? Pretty much. Not much out there that's reliable. So, you know, the First Noble Truth, things are unreliable. And the Buddha said, understand that unreliability. And understand your reaction to that unreliability. That's where the rub happens. The unreliability is like a fact. It's just the way things are. But that unreliability hits us inside at a really deep level. That it's just like, we don't like that. We do not like that unreliability. And so we clench around it. We tighten around it. We fight it. We want to control it. We want to fix it. We want to change it. So we resist. We have a reaction to that unreliability. And that experience of that reaction to that unreliability, that is the feeling of dukkha. That is the feeling of, could be as simple as things just aren't right, or it could be as vast as, you know, what we would really call suffering. So looking right at that, not flinching from that, not flinching from that feeling of dissatisfaction with that unreliability, that's really a doorway. If there's some feeling of dissatisfaction, any feeling of dissatisfaction, there's something that can be understood and some learning that will help to take you towards a truer happiness. Even the subtlest kinds of dissatisfaction, if you're ready to be honest with yourself and acknowledge, yeah, I don't like it that guy cut me off in front of, you know, that guy kind of jumped in front of me on the freeway. I mean, often these little things, it's just like we kind of brush them by. We don't really acknowledge our flinches or our reactions to, sometimes they send us into a huge reaction, but often there's a lot of things that happen in our day that are just these small kind of little, ugh, don't like that, or, and if we're willing to actually look at those too, there's a lot there. Every place there's any kind of rub, there's something that we can learn. You know, that sometimes people in a kind of a new agey way, they say, oh, the universe gives us the lessons we need. Well, I think this is true. I mean, we get the lessons we need. The universe gives us the lessons we need because what's happening is that the universe is interacting with our minds and we're clenching around this unreliability. And those very places of clenching, the clenching is in our own minds. So however we're moving through our lives, we're flowing along, moving along, and then poof, something happens. we meet something that creates that real sense of unreliability in our minds, and there's a grasping and a clenching in our own minds. That sense of fighting that unreliability happens in our own minds. That's why we get the lessons we need, because what we're meeting as we navigate the world is the way our minds clench and react and struggle with what is presented. And it is our own minds that we can free, that we can learn about. And thank goodness, you know, actually that feeling of suffering is actually a product of our own minds rather than something inherent in the world, because it does mean there's a way out. And this is what the Buddha discovered. And so I actually think, you know, even though the teaching is framed in terms of suffering, you know, it is really a pointer to happiness. If we're willing to, with wise attention, turn and look at our struggles, it will guide us to happiness. Because, like in my own practice, just watching, you know, various states come up, patterns come up over and over again, habits and patterns around, oh, anger or self-hatred or loneliness, just willing to watch them over and over and over again, it's like the mind began to understand how it was creating those states itself. So the willingness to turn with wise attention towards the feeling with real honesty. Loneliness is happening. What's it like to be lonely? What's that feeling like? Not with aversion, not with wanting to get rid of it, but more with an interest. What's this? What's it like to be a human being that feels lonely? The mind, in being in that willingness to explore things in that way, learned so much about how the processes of mind were creating that very loneliness. It wasn't inherent in the world. It was in how this mind was meeting the world. And as, I mean, another great bit of news, I think, is that our mind and body, our organism, kind of inherently wants to move towards well-being. It inherently wants to move in that direction. But there's so much delusion in our minds that we've talked ourselves into thinking we know what well-being is and how to get there, and we're actually getting in our own way. And so essentially what this process of wise attention does is it begins to pull back some of those veils and gives the mind an education in, you know, that process of loneliness, you know, watching the process of loneliness. I could feel the mind just clench down and start to tell this story. It's like, oh, you're such a miserable person. You're never going to be happy again, and nobody's going to ever love you again, and you're going to be alone for the rest of your life. It's all a story. Well, the mind is telling itself a story, whipping up that feeling. You see this with mindfulness, and the mind recognizes, well, that's not useful. I mean, it's not so much that what we do is see it and then say, oh, that's not useful, I'll stop doing that. I wish it were that easy. It would be great if it were that easy. But what seems to happen is, I mean, those patterns are really well grooved in our minds. They've been practiced a long time. And so essentially we have to watch them for a long time. But the willingness to watch them over and over again, it's like, the watching of them doesn't regroove them. The watching them with wise attention doesn't regroove them, doesn't keep entrenching them. Watching them with wise attention seems to be able to let them loosen and kind of work themselves out. I've seen so many of those deep ingrained patterns just fall apart over the course of the years of my practice. So that willingness to turn towards our dukkha is the path. It's the It's a pointer for us. So anytime there's any kind of struggle, suffering, dissatisfaction, meet it, turn towards it. I'm going to stop here for a minute and see if there's any comments or thoughts or questions or... So the Buddha offers some teachings for us that kind of point this way of allowing, or you know, this question of dukkha helping us to understand the practice or the path. And one of those teachings is from a teaching he gave his 7-year-old son. I mean, so this is a teaching a 7-year-old can understand. But when we really listen to it, it's a pretty potent teaching. Basically, he suggests looking at where our actions of body, speech, and mind might create suffering or might create affliction, not just for ourselves, but for others. So he suggests to his son, you know, before you do an action, reflect. Is this going to cause somebody suffering? Is it going to cause me suffering? Actually, it uses the word affliction rather than suffering. So is it going to cause affliction to someone else or to myself or to both? And if it is, then don't do it. While you're doing an action of body, speech, or mind, if you see that it is causing affliction to self or others, or both, stop doing it. After you've done an action of body, speech, or mind, reflect, did it cause affliction to self or others, or both? If it did, then essentially make amends and undertake the resolve to try to do better in the future, to not do that again. So in this sutta, the Buddha actually says, you know, look at how our actions are our actions creating pain, struggle, distress for others or for ourselves. Kind of use that as a guide. If it's, or you know, use it as something to help us to understand. It's not a guide to follow. It's a guide to say, oh, that's, you know. So when we see that there's affliction created, it's like, okay, that's a signal. Let's shift gears. So the first two aspects of this, you know, look at do actions of body or speech create harm or affliction? This is really in the realm of ethical conduct, you know, in the realm of non-harming in our relationships. So this is a kind of the ground of some of the practice. You know, if we're really interested in true happiness for ourselves and see that that true happiness for ourselves means that we will not be suffering, then that creates this kind of sense of, okay, if that's really my kind of beacon, non-suffering is my beacon, then let me try not to create suffering. So that's part of the exploration in our practice, to look at in our actions, how are we engaging with others, you know? To take feedback. This is essentially allowing the world to offer us feedback, not just our own wishes and desires, because so often we can delude ourselves if we're not taking in that feedback. You know, there's a kind of a poignant story. I've told this before. Some of you may have heard this here. I saw this on This American Life, Some of you may have seen this. This was on the television version rather than the radio version. So it was a number of years ago. And there was a story on This American Life about a improv theater called Improv Everywhere, and they're still around. I recently saw an article about something they're doing in New York City right now. So they do things like the one they're doing right now is no pants on the subway day, you know. So everybody, there's a whole bunch of people who are just going onto the subway in their underwear, and you know, so it's, you know, just that kind of thing, you know, that they do, this kind of performance art. This is an improv kind of thing, and so that's the kind of thing that they do, the kind of art improvisation that they do, and this story that they told was what they call you know, they give names to their improvs, their improvisations, and what they called this one was the best gig ever. And their idea was to find some little tiny band who hadn't had much, you know, exposure, and give them the best gig of their life, you know. So that was how they expressed it, you know, the best gig ever. Let's give these people the best night of their life. And so, you know, they got these group of people together. They found a band called, I think it was called the Ghosts of Pasha or something. And this little band was scheduled to play in a little tiny bar or something club in New York City. And they had a whole bunch of people. Basically what each of the actors in the improv did was learn all the songs of this band. You know, they were all posted on the internet. So they learned all the songs of this band, and all of these people descended on this nightclub. You know, 50 people, 50 improv artists descended on this nightclub, and, you know, the band was playing along, and, you know, some people were, you know, dancing around, and some people were just, like, standing there swaying and mouthing the words, the lyrics, and, you know, so they were really, you know, acting, being into it. And the band is like, wow, you know, this is great. You know, they had the greatest gig. And it's like a great night for them. Felt really good. And then, you know, it was over and the performance artist dissipated really fast. And then, you know, the group, Improv Everywhere, has a website. So they posted their quote, art, performance, whatever, as what they had done on the internet, gave the name of the group, and, you know, people started looking up that group and listening, and word got back to the group that night had been a performance. It had not been a genuine response from the audience. And other people who heard about this started, you know, posting internet things that were trashing the band and saying that they were fools for having believed I mean, it's just like, and the band, there was like two members of the band, they were devastated. You know, it was very painful for them, very hurtful for them. In this show, This American Life, the leader of the Improv Everywhere group said, you know, our intentions were good. And I thought, and my heart kind of sunk when I heard that. You know, it's like, where my mind went was, suffering was created. Don't just stop with your intentions were good. It's true. You know, they wanted to give this group this great gig. So, but don't just stop with my intentions were good. Look at the fact that this caused harm. it created suffering. So that's feedback. It's like, what wasn't understood? It's not like we should beat ourselves up about it, but if we take an action, even an action where our intentions are good, and we see that somebody suffers from that, that's a point for reflection. You know, what is it that I don't understand here? So a couple of things about this. I mean, one, the first one that popped into my mind was, you know, most of their performance art is kind of public. You know, it's like, yeah, they're in the subway without their pants on, or, you know, they're striking poses in Central Park where, you know, people are wandering through Central Park and suddenly everybody at the same time, a whole bunch of people strike a pose. It's kind of like, what do they call that? Flash mob, that's what it is. It's kind of like a flash mob, you know. So it's public. It's public, and it's not targeted to individuals. It's whoever happens to be in the park, whoever happens to be in the grocery store, whatever, whoever happens to be in the subway. This was targeted to specific people, and it made me think, you know, maybe that should be something you learn from this. You know, maybe your kind of art shouldn't be targeted to individuals. And I was talking to a friend of mine about this, and she said, well, the other part is the whole thing was based on a lie. The whole thing was based on, you know, they weren't really into the music. They were acting it out. And so that's another piece. You know, maybe this kind of performance art shouldn't be based on a lie. So that's the kind of exploration to make. You know, it's like, so yes, there was good intention. But don't just stop there. Look at, you know, it's feedback for us. When they're suffering, it's feedback. What don't we understand? It's a place for learning for us. So the this teaching around looking at our actions of body or speech and how it causes affliction or suffering, that's kind of in the realm of our relationships. And then the third part of that, which is kind of like the mind-blowing piece that he gave this to his son, you know, when there's an action of mind, before you make an action of mind, is it going to cause suffering or harm to yourself or others? This is a really deep instruction. You know, this reflection on an action of mind. Actions of mind are actually largely not under our control. Actions of mind are, you know, there's kind of a level of what we are aware of in terms of our actions, our mind, our choices that we make consciously. You know, I'm going to go do this today, or I'm going to go do that today. But there's kind of there's a level under which many of our motivations, many of our actions spring from a level of intention or conditioning that we don't see consciously much of the time. And so the actions of mind that we have some choice over are the actions that we have some conscious choice over. The rest of them are kind of bubbling up and we kind of see them in retrospect, you know. It's like somebody says something and before we know it, we're yelling at them, you know. In that action of speech, there's been a whole lot of action of mind already that we just haven't seen because it's below the level of what we're consciously aware of. And what we find is ourselves in the process of yelling at somebody or something like that. And so this instruction about looking at our actions of mind, it starts by, okay, look at your conscious choices. You know, look at the conscious thing you're doing consciously. So it's really about looking at your choices. What choices are you making? And those that are conscious, the suggestion is check it out. Is it going to be something that will cause you harm or not? So one instruction, another teaching that the Buddha offered was around thought. And he said, I found with my thoughts some thoughts, I could put them in like two categories. Some thoughts, you know, they just weren't very helpful. And those thoughts were generally thoughts of ill will, thoughts related to wanting things, you know, sense desire, wanting to have things and create things, and thoughts of cruelty. He said, when I saw thoughts like that, you know, those were not helpful. And so I tried to put them aside, you know. Let's not go to those thoughts. And then there's other thoughts, he said, based in love and compassion and wisdom. And he said, I saw that, you know, those weren't going to hurt anybody. So, you know, he could see that the thoughts of ill will, of cruelty, of sense desire. I won't go so much into sense. That's a whole talk. Maybe I'll give that talk when I come back in March, because I'm going to be away teaching at Spirit Rock next month. But, you know, the whole question of sense desire and why that catches us so much and why it's problematic, that's a huge topic. And I won't try to address it right now. But, you know, even just looking at ill will and cruelty, you know, the thoughts of, you know, well, I don't like that person, or that person shouldn't do that, or, you know, I need to get that person set straight, or, you know, all of those kind of thoughts that are kind of rooted in anger or frustration or aversion. He said, you know, those are going to lead to affliction. They, first of all, the recognition is, yes, if I act on them, if I choose to act on that thought, it may lead to affliction in others as well as myself. But what the deeper recognition is that those thoughts, as they come up, the thoughts of ill will, thoughts of cruelty, create emotions, create states of mind like anger, like frustration, like impatience, like hatred. And those states of mind themselves are already causing affliction to this mind and body. So that's the beginning of a deeper exploration, to begin to recognize that that's, again, the turning towards with wise attention those states of mind. And what we see is these states are afflictive. And again, we begin to learn. The mind begins to learn how, again, the thoughts will just create those states of mind. I saw this on my retreat too. Something happened during the middle of the retreat. And I won't go into the details, but there was something that someone did that I felt wasn't very skillful, and that impacted me and my retreat. And for a period of like a few days after that, there'd be this surge of like anger and self-justification and self-righteousness and, you know, a surge of like, I got to tell this person this, that, and the other thing. And I had, you know, committed to myself already. It's like, you know, actually I saw, yes, this does need some action. So that was one thing I acknowledged. This will need some action. I'll need to take some action on this. But not right now, not during my retreat. So I kind of made a commitment to myself. The week after retreat, take some time to reflect on this. You know, think about it in a skillful way, in a balanced way, and, you know, figure out what the right course of action is. So that's part of the process I'm in, you know, this week, having come out of retreat. But, you know, even that kind of saying, okay, I'm going to put this aside, the habit or the pattern of the anger kept arising. I would see an image of the person and phew, the self-righteousness would flare, and it's like, okay, there it is, you know. So it's not that I could just say stop and flip a switch. I had to turn towards it. I had to be with it, to meet it. And there were so many things, so many ways that I found that the mind was catching. It's like Teflon, you know, Velcro, you know, the mind catches. It has all these hooks in there. And several ways in which the mind was really hooked. that was very liberating to see and to understand. One that was kind of amusing at some point, this one was the last one that really kind of let it fall apart, was what I saw was that I was angry because I felt that that event had prevented me from being in mind states that I wanted to be in. It was kind of like I was angry that I was not in the state of mind I thought I would be in had that not happened. I was like, oh, who knows what mind state I'd be in had that not, who knows? It was like, I just had to laugh at myself. And it wasn't an intellectual recognition. That was the deeper kind of seeing and releasing of that. So it was the willingness to turn towards it and to see it that let the mind see at a deeper level what the hooks were. And when the hooks were seen, the mind let them go. So much that can be learned from watching our minds, being willing to turn towards. So this looking at our minds, looking at how our minds create affliction, it's not that we are judging ourselves for that. I mean, I could clearly see the affliction. It was like a split second flash of an image of the person, and a split second later, self-righteousness, and oh, the suffering of that. It was so clear. The self-righteousness was suffering. It was so clear the judgment was suffering. It was so clear the anger was suffering. I couldn't flip a switch and turn that off. You know, so it's not about judgment. It's not about saying it's bad or it's wrong. It's about curiosity. What's this about? The wisdom of the path, the wisdom of the wise attention is what is cultivated. Wisdom is what frees us. The understanding is what allows that letting go to happen. Does this make sense? So, I'll stop again for a minute. We have about 6 minutes left, so not a lot of time left. Are there any comments or thoughts or questions? Yeah.
Wisdom frees us. Are you kind of saying that you know that?
So, yeah, speak into the mic. Yeah.
Wisdom
frees us.
Yeah. So, do you know that?
I mean, I know it in certain ways. I mean, like that instance of that of what I described there, of seeing the way the mind. I mean, in a moment, what happened there was I saw the craving for a mind state that I believed I would be in had that experience not happened. So I saw in the moment that craving come up, and I recognized the delusion of that projection in the moment. So it was a wisdom in the moment that allowed that release to happen. It was a seeing in the moment. It wasn't an intellectualizing or a thinking about. In fact, I'd been thinking about already, actually knew, yes, this state of mind, this is what has to be understood. And, you know, I knew intellectually that that's what I had to do, but just that intellectual understanding wasn't sufficient. It really has to be the seeing. And over and over in my practice, I've seen that. Around anger, for example, around self-hatred, for example. The self-hatred, that was one where I was looking at the pattern of self-hatred come over and over and over again and was caught in it over and over and over again. And the feeling is awful. You know, the feeling of self-hatred is pretty hard and unpleasant to stay with, but I was hanging out with it as best I could. And then in one moment, as I was seeing, I was kind of like in the place where I was seeing the self-hatred kind of make its forays, you know, those little thoughts of you're no good, you're a failure, you're a bad person, those little urges come up in the mind. And in one moment, the mind saw, that arising of those urges or impulses of thought, that they were simply a thought in the mind. And so, again, it was a seeing in the moment that this thing is simply a construction. It's not a reality. And that seeing of that creates wisdom in that moment because it's directly understood in that moment. And the mind just lets go when that happens. So I've seen over and over and over again ways that that's pointed out, you know, that it is the wisdom in the direct seeing. In this last retreat, I got the really clear understanding of just how deep the clinging goes. It's like layer after layer after layer after layer. It's like there's a release at this level, and then you hang out, you know, it's like that falls apart, and it's like, oh, that feels good. You know, it's like, you know, the falling apart of holding and clinging is like being released from a vice grip. Mm. And it's like, whew, that falls apart. And then you hang out in that space for a while, and oh, there's actually more clinging there. You know, it's not just, you know, it's not gone yet. And so it's kind of like there's layer after layer after layer. And the mind is just very stubborn, very determined and very certain that it's going to be able to find happiness in the way it thinks it's going to be able to find happiness. And it has to be shown it's wrong at so many different levels. It has to be shown the delusion of that at so many different levels. But, you know, it sounds like, I mean, describing that, I hope I have a smile on my face, because I thought it was amazing. I mean, it's like, wow, look at that. You know, it wasn't like depressing. It may sound depressing to hear layer after layer after layer after layer of like holding and clinging, but it's like each time a little release happens, there's the real deep understanding, yes, it is the letting go. It's the letting go where the happiness lies. And so that was the kind of, that was a trajectory. So I don't know, did that meet your...
Yes, yeah, you said, you know, from all of it, yes, you were released from suffering.
I wouldn't say I was, I mean, that's a kind of a strong statement. I don't want to make any claims to be fully released from suffering, but just seeing over and over again how the wisdom in the moment at all of these different levels, the wisdom is what allows that release to happen. And it's the directness of that wisdom. Yeah. So we need to stop. Thank you for your attention. Mm-hmm.